This is the Health, Heal and Thrive podcast, and I am your host, Tracy McBee.
Hello, everyone. I hope this episode finds you well. I'm so excited to bring this conversation I had with Dr. Nalam Dharmapriya, who is a GP in Brisbane, who recently had an experience that put her on the other side of the medical profession. Her brother recently passed away at only 53 from cancer. He lived in the US, and the whole experience was obviously very traumatic for him and his family and for Dr. Nalam, and it gave her an incredible perspective being on the other side. And she shared the story of the diagnosis and unfortunately the death of her brother recently, but also what's really come out of it for her, which is a passion to really give people the full story and the options and all that's available to them when it comes to treating cancer. The current medical system is very much locked in the dogma of standard treatment, which involves a lot of drugs and chemotherapy. And Dr. Nalam isn't saying that we shouldn't have that, but there are other options and other alternatives that we owe it to people to give to them, because it is very well researched. The evidence is there that metabolic treatments do and can help certain cancers, and who are we to hold back that information from people? So sit back and enjoy this beautiful conversation. She's a lovely, lovely human being. I have a huge amount of respect for her. She has also agreed to come down from Brisbane to Melbourne in June to be a part of the Lived Experience workshop. And she's going to be doing a talk around the metabolic links of cancer, and also will be doing a smaller session with a smaller group of you at that weekend to really talk stories and to share her insight, her knowledge and her wisdom. If you would like to contact Dr. Nalam, all her details are below. You can reach out to her. She is, as I said, an incredible human being and has a deep, deep purpose just to give people access to the information they need to make the choices that they need to make in terms of their health. Enjoy this conversation. I'll see you again soon. Bye for now.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity, because I do feel really strongly about this subject, and I'll go through it so that your listeners understand. So just before Christmas, no, beginning of January, my brother, 53-year-old, absolutely fit and well, was diagnosed with a metastatic lung cancer with multiple metastases to his brain. Now, he only had symptoms for 2 weeks before he was diagnosed, and that was just dizziness and blurred vision. And, you know, coming from a South Asian family, we thought, oh, he's having a stroke, and was really shocked to find that he's got this diagnosis. And so that's a stage 4 cancer. And, you know, it was very scary for him. He's not a medical person. He's an engineer. He lives in the States. And as you can imagine, it came out of the blue. And so the family, we all went to see him and support him. And so he needed quite a few things. So this was because he had so many metastases, or, you know, lesions to the brain. If you think of the brain is a closed cavity. The skull limits it. So if there's only a small amount of space within the brain. So when you have multiple, he had up to 20 metastases in his brain. So the pressure in the brain from these, what we call space occupying lesions, was massive. And so there was a real concern that when you have pressure, this can cause a lot of problems, including sudden death from part of the lower part of the brain becoming compressed. So it's a very dangerous situation. So his surgical team suggested that he has a craniotomy, which is that they took part of the biggest lesion out of his brain. So, and he that was again a very scary thing, but he went through that really well, and he was he did really well. He came out of the surgery with no real drama. So that was the first tick. Good, great. But then, so he was also started on high dose steroid medication, and this is the usual medication that people with any brain lesion will start on to keep the inflammation and the pressure within the brain to keep it under control. But after he had the brain surgery, that steroid medication wasn't necessary because they'd removed a chunk of the brain, so they stopped the steroid. But then what happened was that 2 weeks later, his symptoms recurred, and when they went and looked at his brain again, not only had the existing lesions enlarged, but there were multiple new lesions as well. So this was just within 2 weeks. So they obviously had to get the steroids back on at a much higher dose. Now, because this happened just before Christmas, and because we're in the US here, the system is slightly different. So a lot of the US, as you know, the medical system is based on an insurance scheme. So what happens is that for certain for any kind of illness, including cancer, the insurance companies have to agree to fund the treatment. Luckily for my brother, his insurance agreed to do that, but it takes time. These things don't happen in a day. And because it was just before Christmas, there wasn't really things. Well, they took time. I
And
mean,
he didn't have time, right?
and
Like,
he didn't have time, but they took time, and it was what it was, and there was nothing we could do about it. But in the meantime, they found that the primary lesion was in his lungs. They did a lung biopsy, and actually that was a very good result that came out of it. The lung biopsy suggested that he had this particular lung cancer that was really amenable to what we call targeted therapy. So it's not like an immune therapy, but it's a specific targeted therapy for this particular lung cancer that he would have to take long term, but that would improve his survival significantly. Now, as it was before with that stage four diagnosis, he had probably, 6 months to a year at the most. But with this targeted therapy, he potentially could have had much longer, possibly 5, 10 years, who knows, longer. So that was very positive. So he came out of hospital with a very positive outlook, even though he had this, recurrence of this brain, the metastases. Everything was positive.
And
And
just
so,
on that, just
yes.
can you clarify with the lung cancer? Because I think everyone thinks, oh, it's a smoker. And you know that, not that there's a judgment in that, but he wasn't a smoker either,
No,
was he?
he
Isn't
was
that
never
amazing?
he never smoked a Tracy, and he was the healthiest person, because and he was so active. His passions were always outdoors. He was mountain biking, hiking, skiing, swimming. If
Wow.
he could live outdoors, that's what he would be. And the family generally had a reasonably good diet. They weren't they, you know they were always conscious of what they ate. So at this point, just before Christmas, he was relatively stable. Now he's waiting to start radiation therapy in the new year. He was waiting to start this new medication in a few days' time. So I thought, with my kind of area that I specialize in, with the low carb nutrition and keto, this lifestyle, and I thought, okay, I am going to go over to the US and spend some time with my brother. And really, I wanted to kind of give him an opportunity to learn about how to do how to adopt a ketogenic diet. And we'll talk about why that is, to be in ketosis and to introduce him to some fasting. So I went over just really to support and to spend time with him. And when I was there, so first when I went, he wasn't sleeping. He was sleeping 2 hours per day, per night. And when I first went, he was tired as expected. You know, he was, as you would expect somebody with a stage four cancer, he was tired during the day because he wasn't sleeping. But as the days went on, I noticed that despite this lack of sleep, his energy levels started to increase. Now, initially, I thought, wow, this is amazing. This must be the keto diet. Because he was like from 2 in the morning till midnight, he's up. He's up. He's kind of. And when he got this diagnosis, stage four cancer, and then that secondary, slightly better prognosis, he decided that he was going to live his life. He'd always lived his life, but he was going to kind of, do everything that he wanted to do. And one of the things that he really wanted to do was he wanted to upgrade. I mean, this might, everybody's different, but he wanted to really upgrade his home because he'd built this home with his wife 10 years previously. And at the time, he didn't have sufficient funds to do everything that he wanted to do. But now he felt, okay, this was the time. So by the time I got there, it was absolute mayhem, Tracy, because there were parcels coming from Amazon morning, noon, and night. Things were arriving, and this was, it was appliances for the kitchen or new furniture, or he's a photographer. He loves photography. Multiple different cameras, lenses, because he loves mountain biking. These bicycles, I mean, like 5 bicycles, like, and then he was rearranging the whole house. So the house was being, all the existing furniture and all the stuff was being thrown out. And it was chaos, right? But he seemed really happy. He seemed really happy. But as the days went on, I realized that, I don't know, there was something not right. He was talking a lot. My brother has always been somebody who's very quiet. He talks when he wants to talk. But I realized that from morning till night, you could hear the drone of his voice. He was always talking. Sometimes he was excited, sometimes he was annoyed. He'd be irritated if we didn't all feel the same passions that he felt. And then I realized that he was becoming very emotionally labile. He'd be really happy 1 minute, but then happy crying another minute, then angry and irritable and getting more aggressive verbally, which, he's always kind of, he's always been somebody who could manage his emotions. So I thought, what's going on? It just didn't seem right. And then and I'm there as a sister, right? I'm not there as a doctor, as a clinician. I'm there just to support him as his family. And my parents, they're both in their 80s. They were there too. And then my mum, she just mentioned, we were talking, and she said, "Nelum, he talks a lot. He's never talked a lot." And then it was like cling, cling, cling. It just, he basically had an episode of acute mania, Tracy. So an acute manic episode. So this is a situation where you just lose that control of your thoughts, really, and you go into this hyper excitatory state. And people who have had acute mania know that it's a very distressing time because, you just lose the usual, what are the words? The constraints on the mind. So the tip, he had every single symptom, this excessive energy, not requiring to sleep, talking, and these what we call grandiose ideas. So in behind all of this is this, I am wonderful. I can do all these things. My mental clarity is better than it has ever been. And despite this cancer, I'm doing so well. I can do all this. And, all of these kind of thoughts, spending, I mean, the amount of money he was spending every morning we'd wake up and he'd spend thousands of dollars. And
Wow.
I'd say to him, how about we wait till you're a little bit better? But no. I am going to get better. I'm going to fight this, and I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to do all of these things. And then the other thing is that the loss of insight. So for somebody who has a manic episode, they don't realize that there's something wrong. They feel amazing. They feel as if they're on top of the world. Nothing can get them down. And anybody who suggests that there could be something wrong is the bad person. So we had to be very, very careful in the way we spoke about things and tiptoeing around the house. And because it'll be one minute he'll be so great, and he has two kids, and the same thing with them as well. One minute he'd be this amazing loving dad, and the next minute he'd be like flip and get really angry because of something that they'd said. So this went on for a few days, and I thought, oh my gosh. So one of the most common reasons for this, I mean, for him there were probably multiple reasons, because he had these metastases in his brain that could impact this as well. But the high dose steroids is one of the reasons that they are a commonly, not commonly, but it is a well-recognized side effect, this steroid-induced manic episode. And also the fact that he wasn't sleeping. Not that that can, but it could have, it probably made his situation worse, because the less you sleep, the more excitable the brain is. So, and then trying to get, so he was under the care of an oncologist, trying to get some assistance to manage this condition, because I could feel that we were heading into a dangerous territory. Because as every day that progressed, he was getting more volatile, more erratic, and his outbursts were a little bit more intense. And I was worried, because I now only had a few more days left in my trip, and I thought, well, how I can't leave here with this situation as it is, because there were vulnerable people at home. So trying to contact his oncology team to say he needs an assessment, either his we need some way of either reducing the medication, he needs a psychiatric assessment. Well, this was really tough, Tracy, because trying to get hold of anybody to do this, because firstly, none of the clinicians, you cannot contact anybody via email. You can only call them. You can only call them. And being a GP and knowing how busy people are, it was very difficult to just pick up the phone and call. So what I did, I actually went one day. I wrote so many letters, and I went with my dad in the morning. He had an appointment that afternoon with his oncologist. I went in the morning and I handed out these letters to all his team and said, this is so important. These letters have to be read, so that by the time we actually went for the appointment, they had the letters. And I had said in that letter that just to keep this at this moment, just keep it, try to avoid telling them that I have brought this to their attention. So they were very good, the initial radiation oncologist, and he suggested that we reduce down the medication. So that was great. That was a good start. But then the symptoms weren't getting any better. This is literally just, that we reduced the medication on this particular day, and by the next day, things were still not bad, still not good, because it takes a few days for things to
Sure.
happen. And in the meantime, I was contacting his main oncologist, and it was really difficult to get through. But eventually, she called me, and basically, I mean, what she said was, well, we're oncologists. So I said, well, yes, but this your patient has all these, he is not well. Not only has he got the cancer and all the issues regarding that, but now he's got a mental health, a significant worrying mental health condition, most likely triggered by the medication that he was given. And she said, well, you just need to get, if he's a risk to anybody, you need to get him into hospital. Now, Tracy, I mean, listen, I myself, as a GP, have said these words to my patient. And I regret saying these words to my patient because it is incredibly difficult to get somebody, an adult male, in the prime of his life, who is experiencing a manic episode, to just go into hospital. It is impossible because why would he, in his mind, he's
There's
the best
nothing
he's ever
wrong.
been.
That's right. And you can't physically restrain them. I know, it's
It is very,
crazy.
and in the US, if we called the ambulance or and said the words that there is a risk here, the police attend. It is very, very scary. We did not want to do that. I didn't want to do that. But then, as I was really, what I was like, well, how am I going to get my brother admitted? He needed admission, not just to be seen as an outpatient, because there was also the worry that he hadn't yet started his radiation therapy for his brain. So the steroids were absolutely essential for his well-being from the cancer point of view. But then this was also causing this mania. So we were in this very difficult situation of he had to be in hospital for this to be managed. So then, as I was worrying and really worried about this, the next morning, he developed what we call acute urinary retention. So this is a urological emergency, and this just, anyway, there was a little bit of a story to it, but basically he couldn't pass wee, he couldn't urinate. And when that happens, the bladder, so his bladder was up to his umbilicus, and this is a dangerous condition because if we don't release the bladder, then it could perforate, it could rupture. And so we managed to get him in. I mean, in my
Oh
head,
dear.
I'm thinking, oh, this my poor brother, because he was in so much pain for that. But thank goodness, because now I can get him seen by somebody. So
Wow,
we got him
wow.
into hospital and got the whole urological side sorted. And tried. So then I'm like behind the scenes talking to anybody I could talk to.
I can imagine.
But still, it was like, okay, the situation is under control. We are going to discharge him. I'm like, what? You cannot discharge him. There's another condition. And I must have made such a nuisance of myself, Tracy, to everybody, because, and I had to say, there is a risk involved. He cannot come home yet until his mental health is under control. So finally, they kept held on to him. They reduced his doses of steroid, and they put him on something to help him sleep, because while he was at home, he was given sleeping medication, but very, very tiny doses, because the oncologists were so worried about the addictive potential, and fair enough, but much less than we would use here in general practice. So it wasn't working. It didn't help him. So, but as an inpatient in hospital, he was they were able to do that properly. So at that point, now he is in hospital, his symptoms were starting to improve, and so those manic, those very kind of out there ideas, and the crazy spending money, all of that started to gradually improve. And then the oncologist decided that they would start his brain radiation therapy while he was in hospital. Now, in the middle of all of this, just before the beginning of January, he did get his medication that was approved by his insurance company for his lung cancer. So he'd started that. He'd been on that by this time for about 2 weeks. So I felt, now this by then I had actually extended my stay, but now I felt that he was in the right hands. And my parents and I, my parents live in Australia too, we traveled back to Australia. So, and we were keeping tabs on him. And then my sister, who is also in Victoria, she decided right now, since I was back, that she would go and see him.
She a GP?
She's a radiologist, so very, very good, because it just really helped. So now, then it turned out, so as now he's receiving his radiation therapy, his moods and all of that is under control. But then 2 days after he started his radiation therapy for the brain, he started becoming breathless, and he needing oxygen. Now this was very unusual, because he didn't have any issues with his lung function before. And then they did tests, and they realized that they grew a virus and a bacteria. So they thought that this was a pneumonia, and they started giving him antibiotics, and he needed and continued with the oxygen. And a whole week went past, Tracy, and he wasn't improving.
Are they
And
still in hospital at
he's
this
still in
stage?
hospital. He's needing oxygen every day, and now he's getting to the point where he can't talk, because every time they take the oxygen mask off, he's so breathless. And I'm thinking, what is going on? If it was an infectious process, surely this would have settled down. And then researching the medication, we realized that the medication that he was on to help with his lung cancer, there's a 2%, less than 2% of people get a condition called interstitial lung disease, which is an inflammatory process of the lung, which, if you get it, there's a 50% chance that you will die. And we knew that this was it, because, and so then, they, looking at doing further investigations, they found that that was it, that he had this inflammation. That, so you know how in COVID time, we had a lot of people who died of lung-related disease, and that was more an immunological reaction against the virus. So very similarly, this medication caused an immunological reaction in the lungs, which literally, it just caused massive inflammation to build up in the lungs. And the
Obviously, an antibiotic, it wouldn't matter how many they gave,
No,
how
and no,
strong, was
and it's
never going to
not
touch it.
antibiotic. It's
No.
not bacterial. It's not
No.
an antibiotic. So unfortunately for my brother, what happened is that the treatment here, Tracy, is high dose steroids. And the thing is, I mean, not they, it wasn't that anybody did anything wrong, because the problem is that you cannot start high dose steroids on someone if you suspect them to be having an infection. So because there was this infection, and that's what they treated, that postponed the steroid getting in by a week, and by the time the steroid did get in, it was too late. And so by the time my sister went, so she went about 10 days after I left, she was shocked when she went to see him, because he was literally bedbound, oxygen, a lot of muscle wasting. He was like half the man he was before. And then, so basically, he became so exhausted from trying to breathe himself that the next step was that he had to be intubated so that he could be ventilated mechanically. And at that point, my parents and I decided, well, we had to go again. So we got in just in time, because as he was in ICU being ventilated, but he had a little bit of, he wasn't he was able to hear us. He couldn't speak, but he could respond. He knew we were there. When he saw that we were there, he had two big tears. When he not saw, but when he heard us, two massive tears that rolled down his face. But we were so glad that we were there, because 2 days later, we had to stop everything, because he simply, even with high dose oxygen, mechanical ventilation, he was not maintaining his oxygen levels, and wouldn't be able being able to do that, you know, without without this support. And you know, we as a family, the whole family, not just my parents, my sister and I, but his wife and his two children, we were all there in the room together, and we discussed all the pros and cons and decided that it wasn't beneficial to him to keep this going and to keep him alive. So we stopped the ventilation, and it was the right thing to do because he didn't even take a single breath after that. And so the reason, you know, it was so he died within 2 months, less than 2 months of his diagnosis. From he suffered, you know, the manic episode was a drug reaction, and then this the interstitial lung disease was also related to the drugs that he was on. So the reason I feel that I wanted to come on and talk about this, Tracy, is that, you know, these medications that we use to treat cancer, they are also toxic. They are also, you know, poison. So they are not without their own problems. And I think, you know, we don't use the holistic, you know, the options that we have that we know that work. So, and we can talk about, and you can ask me questions on the ketogenic diet. There's a lot of information now on the importance of the right diet, the right lifestyle, you know, addressing sleep, addressing stress management, you know, exercise, all of this, even in a stage 4 cancer victim, can make a huge difference. I don't think it would have made a difference in my brother's life in terms of survival time. He probably would have died when he died, but I think his last few months would have been more peaceful. And yeah, that's what I feel. So that's why I'm here, to talk about my experience, and just to say that I think, you know, we don't, you know, that ancient wisdom that we have from, you know, thousands of years of, you know, our evolutionary biology, we have just poo-pooed them. We don't use them anyway. It's all medication. It's all these, you know, techniques that we have only used for the last 50 years that we've put up our, you know, our beliefs in, all of that. So I think that there's a lot more that we can do in this space to help people.
Thank you for sharing that. I think you're super brave, and I think, you know, people like yourself who have an experience like this on the other side, I think can bring back, you know, huge wisdom and insight. I'm hoping I can just ask you just something. You know, when you talked about your brother got the diagnosis and there was no symptoms at all leading up to that, do you think that perhaps there were and they were just missed, or was there literally nothing?
We all asked him so many times, but the only it was he presented with just a little bit of vertigo 2 weeks beforehand. And the problem is that, you know, he calls my mom every week. And when he called my mom also at 80 had a little bit of vertigo. And she said, "Oh yeah, I have that." And then somebody else in his circle had vertigo. So he was like, "Oh yeah, this is some kind of a viral thing." So really that was it. And then he started getting a bit of blurred vision. And then kind of he said to me that, like, you know, if he was going to put something into the microwave, he'd miss the opening. And that's when he realized, oh, this is something's going on here. So, but no, I mean, he 2 weeks before then, because he's a keen mountain biker, his daughter who's in at university had come back for some holiday, and they'd gone on this massive mountain bike with a massive incline, and he had no symptoms.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, a lot of the reading I've been doing, you know, it's obviously a topic I think that we are excitedly learning a lot about, in terms of alternative views, if you like, and treatments. But
it to me, it kind of it's, and I don't know whether, different cancers obviously, are function differently, but I've kind of been understanding that these are sometimes 15, 20 years in the making, a lot like metabolic syndrome. If you think
Yes.
about, insulin resistance to a type 2 diabetes diagnosis, that can be 15, 20 years,
Yes.
right?
Yes.
And sometimes I, and is that your understanding as well? And, can it vary from cancer
Yeah,
to
I
cancer?
mean, I've obviously since then I've done a lot of reading, and lung cancer in particular can present. It is one of the most likely to present with brain metastases. It doesn't present with anything else. He never had a cough. He never had any
Amazing.
nothing. And so his symptoms simply were the symptoms of the pressure in the brain. That was how he presented. So he presented quite late with those symptoms. There was nothing else, and he didn't lose weight. 6 months before he was in Australia, they were visiting us, and we had, a lovely time, and we did all because he loves adventure. So that's whenever we meet, that's what we do. We're always doing something out and about, and there was nothing to suggest that he couldn't keep up, or that there was something wrong. There was nothing. Yeah.
So, obviously you've had a huge amount of insight and reflection on this experience, and you talked about the ancient wisdoms of treating the whole body. I think that's what you're trying to say, because you talked about the silos. You were talking to your oncologist about a mental health issue. Well, that's not my field.
Yes.
You have to, and I think for your brother, I mean, having you there, I mean, he'll never obviously, know just how incredibly lucky he was. For the average person who doesn't have your knowledge and insight to push through that, it's almost like you get into this system and you're totally powerless as to your, I suppose, your role in that because of this siloed approach.
Yes.
What would you like to see change, or what are some of the biggest insights you've had on where we could look at changing? I suppose from a patient perspective, just to make it a different journey, or I don't know, like there is so much, right? It's a big
Yeah,
question.
it is. What the other thing that I because and this is something I think is really important, Tracy. So because of the way my brother presented, and he was really under the care of the hospital team by the time he presented, and he didn't really have a GP involved by then. He has a GP, but the GP was not involved at that moment, and that I think was a real negative, because I think having a good GP who has your back, who can advocate for you, is really important. And that is what I mean. That would have, if there was a GP, all I would have had to do is contact the GP, and they would have. But because there wasn't a GP involved at the time, and things were moving so quickly, it was a difficult scenario. So I really encourage everybody, find yourself a good GP that you get to know, and they get to know you, because I think it is so important to have that person when you need them.
And to advocate for you, just to help
Yeah,
manage all
absolutely.
the
Just to oversee
silos.
and to coordinate, because that wasn't my role there. I'm not, I don't know the system there. I was there simply as a family member, as a support. So yeah. And then also, Tracy, I think one of the things, so we had started my brother on a ketogenic diet, and he was doing a bit of fasting, but as soon as he got into hospital, his doctor said, stop it, stop it,
Of
and
course.
it's of no benefit. And I didn't want to. We didn't, that was fine. He had to feel that he could trust his medical team, so we didn't get involved there, so that was fine. But again, I feel that there's so much now new information coming up on what we call the mitochondrial metabolic theory of cancer, which says that it is really damage over time to the mitochondria. And mitochondria are the energy, the energy generating powerhouses in our cells. And without this power, this energy that we generate, well, that's our life force, isn't it? We need energy for every single thing that we do. And if these mitochondria get damaged, then that, oh, so it's a chronic. So what they say with this theory is that, and it's more than just the theory, there's now a lot of
Absolutely.
research that has been done, and this has been proven time and time again. There are multiple survivors, long-term survivors of stage four cancers who have gone down this path. So what they say is that chronic damage over time to the mitochondria reduce the ability of the mitochondria to produce adequate energy. And so that then leads to the cell adapting to a very primitive method of energy production, which uses fermentation, not oxygen. So 2.5 billion years ago, before there was oxygen on this planet, the cells that we that obviously humans were not alive then, but the cells that were alive they didn't use oxygen because there was no oxygen. So they used to use fermentation to produce energy. So they used whatever substrate, whatever fuel that they could get, fermented it and produced an acidic environment. That's fermentation, not using oxygen. So these cancer cells, what happens is if over time the mitochondria get damaged, and the mitochondria are not able to produce adequate oxygen to sustain this cell. So this cell, they're so, I mean,
They're amazing, aren't
yes,
they?
amazing. So they adapt. So this is not acute damage. If, say, you know, somebody was poisoned by arsenic for by some or something like that, that's an acute damage that kills the cells. A dead cell cannot become a cancer cell. But this is over time, and that's what you said, Tracy. This is something that happens over time, you know, over a period of time, some damage has occurred, and it hasn't killed the cell, but it's just not able to maintain its energy levels sufficiently. So it has time now to adapt to a system that gives it the ability to survive. So it's basically a survival strategy for these cancer cells. But so the fuels that they can this these cells use are usually glucose and another one called glutamine, which is an amino acid, which is a breakdown product of protein. These are the two substrates that are used by these cancer cells, and this fermentation process is a very inefficient method of producing energy. So the cell has to gently eat up huge amounts of this fuel to be able to produce adequate energy to survive. So the idea is that if we can somehow stop or lessen the amount or starve this cell of its fuel, then these cells, because they're so primitive now, because they're not like our normal cells in the body that are able to adapt very quickly. These cancer cells, because they're so primitive, they don't have a lot of capacity to adapt for once they've become this cancer cell. So if you starve them of energy, they can't do much more. They just literally get weaker and weaker and they die. So that is the idea behind the mitochondrial metabolic theory of cancer, that we can do two things. So if what can we use to starve this cell of cancer, starve this cell of fuel? What can we use to starve the cell of glucose? It's a ketogenic diet. It's being in ketosis, right? If you're in ketosis, then you don't have any glucose, one. And also, when you're in ketosis, and the ketone bodies themselves are not fermentable fuels. But for us to be able to use ketone bodies as fuel, we need oxygen. So the cancer cells cannot use these ketone bodies as fuel.
So
So,
it's not like they would get fixed, with the ketones. They just basically starve and they die off.
yes, they die. But the ketones, because we know that the ketones are so good for the rest of the body,
That's right.
they improve the health of the rest of the cells while starving this. So being in ketosis improves the rest of the body while starving the cancer cell. And then secondly, water-only fasting. So that's another way of increasing the ketone bodies in the body. And so this is not something that you can do long term, but a lot of people who have these diagnoses will do a 5 to 7 day water only fast every month or something. And this is for the benefits of autophagy, the cell cleaning mechanisms, the recycling mechanisms that the body goes through. So this new theory, it's not a new theory,
No,
Tracy. It's been
it's
around for
not.
100 years. Otto Warburg firstly, Warburg firstly documented it, I think, in the 1920s. But you know, when I went with my brother for his first appointment for his new medication, he asked his nurses about being on a ketogenic diet. They didn't know what a ketogenic diet was. So this was his oncology team, and I couldn't believe it. Like, this is massive, you know. And I'm not saying you go one or the other, but why can't you do both together? Because there's been so many studies to show that if you're on chemotherapy or radiotherapy and you're in ketosis, then you have a much better. Firstly, you tolerate these medications much better. You don't need as much in terms of dosage, and the survival is better. So why can't we?
Why wouldn't you? I
Yes,
know
what harm can it do?
that's it's such an interesting approach. And I first a lady, one of my colleagues, Martha Tettenborn, who has a book, Biohacking Cancer, or
Yes.
keto, using so it's using so she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in her early 50s.
Yes.
And she, was actually a nutri she's a dietitian. Thought
Right.
she was, unbelievably healthy. So obviously it threw her off her feet. And she came across the ketogenic diet after a lot of research. So she went into her chemo treatment,
Yes.
with having fasted leading up to it. So this was about in 2017. She's got a book out. It's a great book, sort of going through the process of it.
Process. Yeah.
And I met her in San Diego when I was over in at Low Carb USA last
Yeah.
year, and we were talking about it. And what she said she now understands with that is that the fasting, it what it, it for want of a better way of it, describing it, it's obviously a lot more complex than this. But
Yes.
she said the healthy cells of the body, they kind of it's like they sink to the bottom of the pool, and then you have the chemo treatment, and it really doesn't touch the healthy cells. It just literally targets.
Yeah.
So she said that, she knows now why that approach worked so well, and she didn't get as sick at all. She recovered a lot quicker after the treatments. I mean, she's in full remission now and vibrantly healthy.
Yes.
And I think it's just, you're right. It's, well, we know why. A lot of people don't want to look at, it doesn't suit the way that the medical system is set up. But I think, there is so many opportunities, I suppose, for people to empower people enough to find the
Yes.
information to hopefully, know that it's a safe. In fact, it's so well, known and understood, actually, that it is incredibly safe, and if not, much more effective treatment.
That's right. And and then the other things like sleep, and because sleep and stress, these things, poor sleep, high levels of stress, they increase cortisol levels, increase glucose within the system, so that you're fueling your cancer cells. Well, as so it's really important that these things, I mean, ideally I would like to see where when somebody's diagnosed with cancer, whatever stage, that they're offered these in conjunction with whatever medical therapies or radiation therapies that we have, and that they are given as much importance. Yeah.
But the hard thing is with that. So, you people listening to you, Nellum, well, I know there'll be people listening, and I'll go, okay,
Yes.
well, I know I would like to see Nellum, and you would be
Yes.
an amazing advocate for that. But then they go off to their oncologist, and their oncologist will say, oh, there's no evidence of that. That's don't, I think, we have to empower people so much
Yes.
to be able to stand up to a specialist who says, no, well, I'm still going to give it a
Absolutely.
go. It's
Yes.
very, very challenging for people, isn't it?
I think so. And I think you're right that empowering, because if all you had was the radio and chemotherapy, You are powerless and you are in somebody else's hands. Well, if you had, you could go on this, you could, change the way you eat. You could start fasting, just start some resistance exercise. Let's get the sleep sorted. You know, all of these
And the
things.
light therapy as well. Have
It's
you?
all of this. So that gives the person control a little. They are also involved in their care. It's not
Which,
just, yes, it's massive.
yes, it
Yeah.
is massive. But I think there is so much potential in that. And I think it's wonderful that you're sharing what you are. The mitochondria is, I've done a lot of research around it to my group, about to go into a
Yeah.
whole topic around it
Yes.
again. And I just love it,
It's
learning about it.
fascinating.
And I
Yeah.
start by saying, we are really only as healthy as our mitochondria. I mean, it is, and you've just described that. I think everything we can look at in terms of, well, what are the things, it's so much beyond weight loss. Like, it's just like, oh my gosh, we need
Absolutely.
to look at it in terms of our health. And one of the things I'd like to ask you too is that there's a lot of, not fear, but a lot of people don't, they kind of go, oh yeah, I'll go a little bit low carb, but they don't really do enough to get into ketosis. I think there's a
Yes.
bit of a fear of, well, should we be there long term, blah blah blah. And I think they're seeing it through the lens of simply weight loss instead of mental
Yes.
health and obviously the fueling of the cells. So what would you say to someone around that? Is it safe long term? Do you think the body naturally mitigates, in and
This is
out, or
very safe long term because if you go back in our evolutionary biology, that's more than likely where we were most of the time, that we were in ketosis, and that's how we were formed. That's why we carry so much fat around in our bodies, because that's what we use to fuel ourselves, right?
Okay, we've got our own fuel tanks.
Exactly. So, the thing is that if for certain conditions, it's not just about being low carb. You have to be in ketosis. So for things
Absolutely.
like cancer, it is really important if you're doing it, you're doing it so that you actually are in ketosis. And I think that is, so epilepsy, for instance, is another one. There are certain, and a lot of mental health conditions, really to maintain ketosis. Yeah. So I think for weight loss and for maybe other kind of, diabetes, heart disease, things like that, you could go low carb and that could be enough. But certain conditions, I think you really need to be in ketosis to benefit. And there's absolutely no long-term risk of being in ketosis, not the therapeutic, the therapeutic ketosis that we're talking about. Yeah.
No, I absolutely agree with you. That's certainly what I, the conclusion I've come to. And every time I get an opportunity to ask a doctor who, who really
Yeah.
understands it, that's the answer that I hear. I think it's people who generally misunderstand, the complexities of it that might talk
Yes.
about that. But
Yeah.
anyway, I also would love to ask you, Nilam, I'm conscious of the time. Hopefully you've got a few more minutes,
Yeah,
but
no, that's fine.
you as a just the incredible human being you are, how did you actually manage the stress? Like, what were some of the things that you were really conscious of going through this experience, whether looking back on it or what you noticed going through, that you think were really important for you as a family member of someone going through this to focus on?
So Tracy, so I'm a practicing Buddhist, and that really helped me, because yes, and I think that I wouldn't have coped otherwise, well, as well as I did. I do a lot of meditation, and just in Buddhism, the concept that, death is the only guarantee in life, really. And it comes, there is no guarantee when it's going to come. We are not born with a sticker that says expiry in 70 years or whatever. It comes. And I think just that realization that for my brother, this was it, and that there is going to be loss here. And that it is the way it is. And I think really those roots, going, really kind of digging deep into my spiritual learnings, and talking to my sister, who we both are the same. So, really, that really helped. That really helped. And then being there with the whole family, making decisions together, Making decisions that were really about what was the best thing for my brother, was because, it was very difficult for my sister-in-law and the kids, not having a medical background. And suddenly we, here they are, in this room, and we're talking about, stopping his ventilation. And so really kind of being able to explain to them, to talk to the specialists that were there, to give them the opportunity to ask the questions. And you're right, Tracy, how my brother's situation was a very complex situation. How anybody else would have managed it without any medical knowledge, I feel really humbled that I had that knowledge and my sister was able to help with the radiology side of things. Otherwise, it was, where would you? There's so many things that went on, and this kind of scenario must happen to so many people,
The
you know.
common, my, that's the common scenario.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah,
In that, I talk not in, to, in terms of exactly how that played out with your brother,
No,
but
but
just
that's right. Yes.
that system approach that you really just become a number. I mean, there's no one advocating for you. There's no one sort of crossing over that whole mind body thing unless you have someone like yourself in your family or you have that ability to do that yourself. And if you're that
Yes.
unwell, you don't. I mean, your brother lost, his
No,
ability to,
absolutely.
very, very difficult. What, I think that's lovely. Well, that faith, I guess, and that understanding that holds you true. I'm not Buddhist, but I love the Buddhist philosophies and the practices are very similar to me as well. And I think there is a knowing that this is one part of our journey, our life here. And that's helped me deal with, kind of grief, knowing that it's only short term and that we'll meet again. But
Exactly.
there was a program, I'm not sure if you've seen it on Netflix once. I don't even know if it's on now, called Experiencing Death. And it
Yes,
was, have you seen that?
I did. Yes, it's.
There was one of the episodes where I talked to a doctor who ended up doing a lot of study on what happens prior to someone passing and how their loved ones tend to come back and get them. It actually got me, it gets me really emotional because I think, we have so much of a fear around it because we don't necessarily understand it. But
Yes.
there is, we can look at it, in a loving and a different way. We're in an,
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. In the Buddhist traditions, we don't say rest in peace because that is not, we say, because there's an ongoing journey, that may your journey, be, wherever you're heading. So there's an ongoing journey, and that journey will eventually end. But that we don't rest in peace. There's an ongoing, so there's life after life. It carries on, as you said. And so that's so, so we wish him well in his journey.
Well, to finish up, I'd love you just to share any, anything that you'd like to share that you haven't said, or just a final sort of, something, wisdom you'd like to say.
I really feel that in modern medicine that we have lost touch with, as you said, the ancient wisdom that we have, that we know is there, and that I think, we put too much emphasis on these very new technologies that really we haven't had a lot of experience with. And it's great that we've got, all of this new research going on, but are we barking up the wrong tree? All this cancer research that goes, money that goes into the somatic mutation theory of cancer, saying that it's a genetic disease. Well, the last 100 years, this cancer survival hasn't improved. So, so I think we, as physicians, I think the medical profession, I think we need to really look back and really embrace some of these holistic therapies that have been there for many, many, centuries. Why do we not use those? And I feel that when we do, it's very much a lip service. We say things like, oh, you need to eat well, or you need to lose weight, exercise. But beyond that, there is no other instruction. So that's because we don't know, because we're not taught that, and it's not deemed important, not important enough anyway, as the pharmaceuticals or whatever. So I think that is the message for me. I think we need to look beyond just this new stuff that we have, but also embrace and connect with all those the ancient wisdom that we have. That's really important.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nellam, for sharing your story and your experience. And I truly believe too that sometimes we're gifted with these experiences, not because we choose them, but because there's something that we are then going to be able to give to the world. And I can't wait to watch this sort of unfold for you and the passion behind. There's a different level of passion when it's been a lived experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you,
Thank
Dr.
you,
Nellam.
Tracy. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to chat to you and your audience.